Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Thanks so much. Turn the lights off. Almost Christmas. Thank you. So, a brief note, why do I talk about Christmas? Well, to me, all the talks I do are connected. And it started for me, as you know, most of you, with Croxair, of course. And then, of course, you start to realise you're not being told the whole truth about things, and then you meet people like Marcus, and then you get into conspiracy theories, and before you know it, you know, or if it's someone like me, loudmouth, you start talking about these things, and then people seem to like it, and they ask you to come along and talk about them. But I've also always been fascinated by folklore, and growing up in Lewes, with all the bonfire night and that, and that's one of the lectures I give, because I feel quite passionate that that should carry on. And by the way, that was way over-policed this year. Were you there? Is anybody there? The police presence was totally out of order, and blocking all the roads off. You what, police state? Right, there was the evidence. But anyway, that's another story. So Lewes people, they have a reputation for wanting to get to the bottom of things and know more. And so then, of course, you start to be interested in other festivals. And I've always loved Christmas. I was brought up in a household that did Christmas. And as the years went by, I thought, actually, where does all this come from, you know? You just take it for granted, don't you? Christmas comes along, and what the hell's it all about? Why do we do it? So obviously, if you've got a religious view, you're going to have, you know, one reason for doing it, and we're going to cover everything here. As much as we can in whatever we got, an hour, 55 minutes. So, what I want to do here is what I've been doing for the last few years, is just sharing with people where this all comes from. And Christmas means different things to different people, and yet at the same time, it means the same thing in many different ways. So we're going to see how all this blends together. And there's so much more to it than people think. And so gradually, I just found myself giving talks about Christmas. And so I'm now going to do it for you as the double bill. So there we are. So, over the next few weeks, all of this is going to be going on, Mr. Reynolds. Right? We're going to have all kinds of strange things going on that we just generally don't do to this degree all at the same time at any other time of the year. And it's funny, isn't it? Because why? Why do we do this? What's that all about? And it's partly habit, because it's just what human beings do now. But that, to me, that's not good enough. I want to understand how we got to this stage. So let's begin by asking a question. Now, when we decorate our homes, why are we doing it? Why do we decorate our houses? What statement is that making? And ultimately, what you're doing by changing the environment around you, of course, is changing the way you feel. You are saying, I want to be different. I want to feel different during this time of the year. And that's the only time of the year we do it, to that degree, for those of us that do decorate our homes. And the other thing you will notice is, of course, often they're echoes of nature, and they glow. And, of course, that's reminding us, in essence, that at this cold, dark time of the year, any little glow you can get, well, you grasp onto it, don't you? And nature is very dormant at this time of the year, for the most part. So, to the ancients, it was a crucial time to know when the sun might come back, because life was hard at this time of the year. And having some way of marking when you knew the beginning of the warm times were going to come was important. So basically they built clocks, giant clocks made of stone. And whatever else Stonehenge is or isn't, one of the things it most certainly is a seasonal clock. And one of the discoveries that I think is quite revealing in the last few years is that the primary alignment is not for midsummer. Yes, there is an alignment for midsummer. The main alignment is for the midwinter sunrise. And we now know from looking at remains and that midwinter was the huge festival at Stonehenge. So that was the time of year that mattered more to them than any other time of year. And of course, today, people still celebrate the solstices at Stonehenge. So it's worth a quick look at what solstice means. Because again, we just say the word, we don't think too much about it. It's Latin, and it literally just means the sun stands still. So because of our orbit and the tilt of our planet, of course, you get seasons. And so when you get to an average 21st of December, and that can drift, but on average, it's 21st around there.
the sun will come up at exactly the same point for 4 days running. So it appears to stand still. And of course, it's at its lowest point. But then, on an average, 25th of December, it starts the first discernible movement. And then, of course, it's beginning its rise back up. So that was the day you celebrated. It was like, yes, it's coming back. You've seen the evidence. Warmth will come again. The crops are going to grow. Hey, let's have a lovely time. So inevitably, festivals grew around this all over the world. And I mean, there are so many different versions of it. In the ancient Egyptian culture, the birth of Horus was said to be celebrated around the solstice. And there are various versions out there on the net that are not accurate, saying that he was visited by three wise men and all of that. That's actually made up. There is no evidence to support that claim. But yes, his birthday was celebrated around the solstice. And interestingly, his mother, of course, was the goddess Isis, in the best sense of that word. So the story of how Horus was born has got a lot in common with what then comes with the nativity story. And that doesn't do down what then follows, but it's a restatement of a sacred truth. So Horus's father, Osiris, had already been murdered before Horus was even conceived. It's long and gory. We won't go into that tonight. So Set had murdered Osiris, and Set was Horus's uncle, and now he wanted to murder Horus. So Horus had to be born in secret and brought up in secret and was on the run. And of course, that has an echo of what then happens in the King Herod story, because Herod wants to kill Jesus, and Jesus basically has to be brought up in hiding in Egypt. So there's a lot of resonance between these two stories. And there's various other things besides, which you can read much more about in the book, but I'm skipping through tonight. Another god that has a solstice birthday is Mithras. Now, the Mithras cult was a big thing over here, especially in Roman Britain. And the military, especially, military men liked Mithras. He was always tackling bulls, all kinds of astrological significance in there. Mithras, again, had an unconventional birth. He was born out of a rock in a cave. And in the Mithras story, you get the sun god, the Sol Invictus, which just translates as the unconquered sun, basically. And Sol Invictus comes along and plays his role in the story. And guess when Sol Invictus's birthday is? 25th of December. And there are other deities around the world that basically have the same day, because, of course, it celebrates the return of the light. And whether you see that literally or figuratively, it's all amounting to the same thing. And you can see here how the depiction of Sol Invictus is just transferred seamlessly by the Romans to early Christianity. So there's almost been a blink. It just becomes Jesus in time. And the same symbolism, the halo, continues on. And that does not do down what comes later. It, to me, makes it actually more fascinating. So the Romans, of course, had a number of festivals that grew around this time. And much of what we do at Christmas has a lot to do with the Romans and other cultures, but we'll start with the Romans. So one of the festivals they had was Saturnalia. So that was generally rather out there, lots of drinking, a bit debauched very often, and it was celebrating the old days of Saturn, the god Saturn or Kronos, when everybody was free and easy, and they went back to being free and easy and happy and being very silly. And you get an echo of this come back in the later misrule festivities of the medieval times, which we will come to. But the other festival, which tells us a lot about modern Christmas, was the Calendai festival, effectively a New Year festival. Read this description of Calendai by the 4th century Roman Libanius. Everywhere is singing and feasting. The rich enjoy luxury, but the poor also set better food than usual upon their tables. Their desire to spend money grips everybody. Is this sounding familiar? People are not merely bountiful to themselves, but to their fellow humans. A stream of presents pours itself out on all sides. So there you go. So that could describe, couldn't it, modern Christmas? And the context has shifted, but essentially we're still doing what they were doing long, long ago before it became the Christmas that we know. And many of the old routines, rituals and traditions we had in the British Isles to do with Christmas actually originate from other countries. And many of them are lost. And aside from that, but if you want to read a really good book about the old Christmas traditions, Read Ronald Hutton's book, The Stations of the Sun. Absolutely crucial reading. If you want to know about all the lost and indeed existing ones, and the origins of them, all the things we used to do, not just at Christmas, but all around the year, right, really do read Ronald Hutton's book. But of course, what we in the British Isles now associate Christmas with is the Nativity, and of course many other countries as well. And we've already seen how there's a link back there to earlier mythologies, and indeed most scholars accept that the iconography of the Madonna and the Child is linked just directly from Isis and Horus. So there is a sacred truth here that just evolves and changes, but it's essentially the same thing. And whatever your religious belief or no religious belief, there is something quite nice about this story. What I really like about this is that the first thing that happens when Jesus is born is that the angels go and tell a bunch of shepherds. Right? They don't go to the rich, they don't go to the nobles, they go straight to the everyday common folk, you know. So this is saying this is going to be a divine wisdom available to everybody, not just the lofty. And that's reinforced by the way we always show the birth of Jesus in the stable, the animals, you know, the lowliest birth you can imagine. Interestingly, the Bible never mentions stables. Farmyard animals don't appear in the Bible, in this story, and yet that's how we always imagine it. It does say there was no room in the inn and they had to lay him in a manger, but manger can mean many different things. And yet, traditionally, this is how we see it. But there might be more to what this is representing than meets the eye. And we'll come back to that point in just a moment. So first of all, it's some lonely shepherds that show up. But then, of course, you do finally get some rather higher powers arriving. So you get the Magi, or the wise men, or the three kings. Now, three kings is a much meter terminology, and we'll talk about that in one moment. So the three kings, who were they? As far as we can tell, they came from Persia. They were probably Zoroastrians. And we get the word magic from Magi. So they probably were astrologers. And the story goes, they saw the sign in the sky, they followed the star, they knew somebody really important had just been born. But could it be they are stars themselves? Because there is a lot of astronomical and astrological allegory, I believe, in the Nativity story. The three stars in the belt of Orion, who later on becomes associated with John the Baptist, in later mythologies, are often referred to as the three kings. There's a number of cultures that call them the three kings. And of course, that they might give you another Egyptian connection, because a lot of people like Graham Hancock and Bavow believe that the three stars in the belt of Orion mirror the three pyramids at Giza, or vice versa. And that what they were trying to do at Giza was to literally recreate heaven on earth. They are mirroring the heavens. And the three pyramids also sometimes get called the three kings, after the three kings who reputedly made them. Now some, of course, argue with that. So there's much more to this. And by the way, the Bible never says they were three wise men. It just says wise men. In some cultures, there were 12 of them. Other numbers in different cultures. The reason we think there were three is because it says there were three gifts. And so everybody imagines three. But it never actually states that, curiously. So stars, very much at the core of the story. So what was a Christmas star, right? There's been a lot of speculation. If it existed at all, some say it was a paranormal event, but others say, well, maybe it was a comet or a supernova. And the only trouble is there's nothing that distinct around that time. Although, interestingly, Halley's Comet was around when Matthew was writing his gospel years after the event. So maybe that inspired him. But other people think it might be one of two things. Some say that it is simply the star Sirius that it's referring to. Sirius, remember, was Isis to the Egyptians, so another Egyptian connection there. On a single night, Sirius can rise and be seen to pass from one horizon to another. So often, travellers would use it to guide them across the desert. So maybe it just refers to that. But then a number of people believe, no, there's more than that. A conjunction is when two or more planets come together in the sky. And this was seen by astrologers, especially in these days, you know, it's very meaningful. Now, interestingly, in 7 BC, you get three conjunctions of Saturn and Jupiter. Now, that would be seen as very meaningful. It was heralding, you know, a whole new era about to begin.
Well, 7 BC is around the time when a lot of scholars now think Jesus was probably born, because he couldn't have been born as late as 1 AD, as we call it, because Herod would have been dead by several years by then. So Jesus had to have been born earlier than that. And it's just strange that many clues, a lot of people say 7 BC, is also the year where you get these three conjunctions. So could it be the Christmas star was actually Christmas planets? And that briefly takes us back to the nativity scene. Because some people, like Adrian Gilbert, believes that the original placements of figures in a crib scene, and they often used to follow the same pattern, is actually an allegory of the sky in 7 BC, showing you when Jesus was really born. So the three wise men, the Mercury, Saturn and Jupiter, and then you've got Taurus, the bull, Aries, the ram or the lamb. Interesting, isn't it? And this, okay, this has got mixed up over the years, not everyone's followed the same placement, but it is quite common. So could it be it's actually secretly encoding when the birth really was? Some believe so. Now, the first time that you see 25th of December having been taken away from Sol Invictus and now given to Jesus is this Roman calendar, the calendar of Philocalus, 354 AD. Now, this is, I think, an interesting moment because the Romans at this stage were just about to become Christianized. So they start to accept Jesus into their kind of pantheon of gods, and then, of course, finally get rid of all the rest of the gods. And what we also find at this stage are arguments about what was the big day. Because Christmas Day, to begin with, was not the biggest day in the early Christian calendar. The Epiphany was. But the Epiphany originally referred to the baptism of Jesus. Okay? And some even said it referred to the wedding at Cana, if you know your Bible stories. It was only later that it became associated with the arrival of the wise men. And so the early church got into many arguments about this, and the Gnostics, and it was all actually quite unpleasant. So finally they had to sort it all out. So they had to hold a council, the Council of Tours in 567 AD. Actually, I'm cheating here, because that's the Council of Nicaea. But there isn't a picture of the Council of Tours, so this will do. So they finally all sat down and they worked out what is the Christmas time calendar going to be. And that's when they finally thrash out the 12 days of Christmas. And here is what they would originally be and then would originally or ultimately evolve into. It changed a bit over the years. So obviously Christmas Day at the top, St. Stephen's Day or Boxing Day, and so on. Suffice to say, I'm sure you will celebrate Pope St. Sylvester's Day on New Year's Eve, yes? No, apparently you should. Actually, some countries do. And one of the ways to celebrate it is to parade pigs on leashes. I've never found out why, but apparently they do. So what this all meant by the time you get to the medieval times is it's, of course, a fantastic excuse for 2 weeks of merriment and feasting. And you get the early beginnings of what would become misrule. But we'll come to that in a minute. Now, another festival got drawn in by this point. Because now we had a lot of exposure to the Germanic peoples and the Scandinavian and the Norse mythology. So Yule or Yol starts to get pulled in. And Yule basically commemorates the wild hunt where the great god Odin was said to be flying around the sky with this kind of rather mad hunt. Probably a bit cold, though. So that's why if you go to Scandinavia, you'll often get a Yule goat hanging on the tree, because that represents the chariot puller of Thor. This is chariot is pulled by goats. You probably didn't go very far. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff around Scandinavia that's not so strong here. And of course, there are many different ways of doing Christmas. Some, as many of you here will know, do the big day on Christmas Eve. Here in Britain, we do it Christmas Day. But there are many variations. But we also picked up from Yule that kind of the veneration of holly and ivy as these sacred plants. So, yes, you get the Christian carol later on, but they were seen as sacred because holly and ivy, at the cold, dark time of the year, was doing very well. And it gave you hope. It showed you that if that could get through this period, so could you. So bringing it into the house and decorating your home with it was a good luck charm, as much as anything else. And that, of course, would gradually evolve into the plastic extravaganzas that we have today. Yeah. And if you ever want to know why you must get your decorations down by Twelfth Night, reason is
it was believed that in amongst all the greenery were elementals, elves and sprites and fairies and that kind of thing. And they were actually generally quite mischievous. But there was a truce between them and us over Christmas. The truce ended on Twelfth Night. So if you didn't get the greenery out of your house by then, they'd be trapped in your house for the next year, getting up to no good. So remember that. Your tree's still out after Twelfth Night, right? And you've got yourself to blame. Now, traditions, of course, then grow around different things. And people not having much money was a big, big issue. So they would do this thing that was called wassailing. It's from the old Anglo-Saxon wassail, which literally means being in good health. So when you chink your glasses and say your health, you are basically wassailing. So you don't want to be arrested for begging, but if you put this sort of bunch of hot spice punch together and went from door to door, you could get a bit of money in return, and you would offer the bowl and say, wassail, and hopefully somebody would give you some money. And the giving of money to the poor became a big part of this time of the year, generally on St. Stephen's Day. That's when the alms would be distributed, and often money would be collected in boxes across the year, and then broken open on St. Stephen's Day, hence Boxing Day. And there are other reasons why we call it Boxing Day. The carol, Who King Wenceslas, of course, commemorates this. So Wenceslas looks out and sees the poor man in the snow, and sends this page down, give him some money, and they bring him in, make him feel nice. So it's commemorating this. Wenceslas was a real man, by the way. Duke of Bohemia in 900 AD, although he was murdered by his brother in the end. Well, there you go. Not very Christmassy. That's how it is. So this all gradually develops into what we call Boxing Day over here. This is a satirical take on Boxing Day from the Victorian times. Because what was happening was anybody that had done the smallest thing for the money classes, they were queuing up at their door on Boxing Day waiting for their money. And this really started to annoy the nobles and the landowners by the end. So it all got watered down, and now, you know, Boxing Day is a recovery day, really, isn't it? Or you go and see a different set of rallies. But once upon a time, it went rather more. They don't really do Boxing Day in America, by the way. A lot of people go back to work on Boxing Day, haven't they? So, the giving of gifts. Well, you saw in that Roman quote, you know, there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on for a long time. In the medieval times, you know, if you had a lot of money, you'd give a fine gift. If you had not much, you might give a token. That wasn't really what they were most interested in. No, what they were really interested in was misrule. So, a kind of a remnant of the Saturnalia of the Romans, but also an element of the Norse wild hunt. This kind of wild celebration. So when people drink too much today and people get very annoyed, you know, we say, that's not in the spirit of things. Well, these people thought it was. They thought if you were getting drunk and stupid, you were doing it wrong. So there was a real letting go. And people would, you know, throw off the cares that they normally had weighed on their shoulders all year round and just get ever so silly and drunk and try and recover throughout January, I suppose. And this would often be led by people like the mummers or the geysers. And they were actually a little bit subversive, because mummers and geysers were the kind of people, they would burst into your home unannounced often, and basically entertain you against your will. You pay them to go away. And yet it was part of the misrule festivities. And one of the things the mummers used to do especially, which was quite shocking for its time, was cross-dressing. Well, what does that remind you of that we still do at this time of the year? Oh, yes, it is. Obviously, it is. So, pantomime. In a way, pantomime is one of the last vestiges of organised misrule. So we're still doing it. And, of course, it's very satirical, and we have a dig at people. So it's a remnant of that. However, when we had the rise of the Puritans, now, this suddenly was all, of course, seen as very immoral. And when people like Oliver Cromwell came to power, this did not go very well. So the Puritans were, of course, very, as you would imagine, purist Protestants. They believed you only followed that which was in Scripture. If it wasn't in the Bible, you didn't follow it. And annoyingly, the Bible didn't give a date for Christmas. So they said, doing Christmas, 25th of December, is a heresy. Right, that's clearly an old pagan date, wicked, evil old gods. We're not doing it anymore. So they campaigned to stop Christmas. And it didn't matter for a while, because they were kind of just a bit of a side issue. But then we got into the English Civil Wars in the 1640s. And that's a long and bloody part of our history that we haven't got the time to go into today. Cutting a very long story short, King Charles I gets into a squabble with Parliament. It falls to a really divisive war. Many people die. And then Oliver Cromwell, this general, gradually comes to leave Parliament. And the king's defeated and ultimately gets his head cut off. But of course, it leaves us under the control of the Puritans. So they could now do anything they wanted. And you know what? They did. So one of the first things they did was ban Christmas. So in 1647, out goes Christmas. Actually, this is an American notice, but it says much what our notice is, what it said. The observation of Christmas, having been deemed a sacrilege, the exchanging of gifts and greetings, dressing in fine clothing, feasting and similar satanical practices, are hereby forbidden. And you could be arrested or fined for doing Christmas. Mad stuff. There were protests. I mean, here's a protest leaflet, the vindication of Christmas. There were massive riots in Canterbury on Christmas Day, the first year of the ban. Various altercations happened up and down the country, but ultimately it was no good. The Puritans weren't giving in. From this time, we did get some interesting things, though. I mean, the 12 days of Christmas, the song with all its weird lords leaping or whatever, might mean more than meets the eye. Some scholars say it might be a remnant of singing your Christian faith at Christmas without getting arrested, because carols were absolutely banned during this period. You couldn't even do that. And some say maybe this was a way, especially for the Catholics who were being oppressed anyway, of having your faith in song. Because some say this is what it all means. So the partridge in the pear tree is Jesus, the turtle doves, the Old and New Testaments, the three French hens, faith, hope and charity, and so on. So maybe the whole thing is mimicry, some say. The carols would come back, of course, and for a while, though, even when they did come back, only certain words were allowed. That's why there's so many different versions of While Shepherds Watch Their Flocks by Night, because you could sing that, because the words were from the Bible, from the Gospel of Luke, but anything else was still seen as very much a no-no, and so people kept reinventing different tunes for the same set of words, otherwise you'd get bored singing the same song. Carols would finally find their heyday, of course, in Victorian times. So Christmas came back because Oliver Cromwell died in 1649, and then nobody knew what the hell to do. 59, sorry. So we invited the monarchy back, and we then got Charles II. So they'd killed his dad, but now he was king, and everything apparently was going to be all right. Well, Charles liked merriment, he liked feasting, he liked Christmas, and now Christmas was back on the menu. But it'd been damaged, and it would take a while for Christmas to come back properly. I mean, not least because up over the border in Scotland, Christmas had been banned as early as 1580. So the Calvinistic preacher John Knox had already scrapped it. And it might surprise you to learn they didn't get around to changing the law in Scotland on that till 1958. That didn't mean they weren't doing Christmas by then, but it does explain why Christmas is not such a big deal in Scotland as it is down here. But of course, all they did was reinvent it in new guises. So Hogmanay, Burns Night, basically they said, all right, well, we'll just do our feasting and jollies another time. Which only goes to show, when you take something away that people actually want, and only reinvent it anyway. And that's one of the ironies. Every year you see these leaflets around complaining about the secularisation of Christmas. The irony is, Protestant Christianity anyway did it to itself. They separated the celebrations from religion, and they never really came back together, not fully. So there we go, one of the great ironies of history. Something else, though, that really held back Christmas from coming back to full strength was the Industrial Revolution. So that took many people out of the countryside, where so many of the old traditions existed, and into these really rather horrible factories that you had to maintain every day. You couldn't stop for Christmas, you've got to keep the furnaces going, got to keep the money rolling in. And families were broken up, and all the things that held Christmas together suddenly were just falling apart. And that caused issues. I mean, depressingly, right, the big newspaper of the day was the Times then. Between 1788 and 1835, there are several Christmas Day editions of the Times that don't even mention Christmas. No one cares. Not interested anymore. So how did it all come back properly? Well, it's generally recognised that one of the big factors was the arrival of Prince Albert. So he marries Victoria in 1840, and they both of them have quite a strong social conscience, actually. They're concerned about the way the family is falling apart and whatever. But of course, coming from Germany, he brings with him many of the German traditions that have not atrophied in the same way over there. So he sees Christmas as a way of instilling the family back as a central focus. So when they start to have children, and then their own family starts to grow, every Christmas there's a clear effort to link the iconography of the royal family with the iconography of the holy family. And it's around this time that people start building cribs. Now there's earlier years where people were doing it, but this is when it gets really popular, because it's used to focus people back onto the idea of the family. Of course, the other thing Prince Albert helped to do was popularise the Christmas tree. He did not invent it. I hear that said so often. No, he didn't. There's records going back to Druidic times of dressed trees, right? So, no, he didn't. But yes, he did popularise it. Because when the front of the Illustrated London News showed this, the Christmas tree at the palace, people around the nation went, whoa, that's lovely. I want one of them. And within a few decades, it was just routine. If you didn't have a Christmas tree, you weren't really doing Christmas. It went out of fashion slightly in World War I because they were seen as a Germanic thing and people protested, so they didn't have one. But they soon came back after the war. Now, other things start to evolve around this time. So the Christmas dinner gets reinstilled. Factories are compelled to give at least one day off so the family can come together over Christmas. So the traditions start to build. And the food that we eat at Christmas, well, I mean, that's come and gone. It used to be roast beef very often, and then all kinds of poultry, goose very often. And turkey comes a bit later. I mean, it's been around since 1500s, but it was very expensive. It's only really 20th century where that really takes over here. Although if you're vegetarian like me, you might be eating turkey. Nothing wrong with a good nap roast, eh? Now, Christmas crackers. They also evolve around the same time. Many countries don't do Christmas crackers. Perhaps surprisingly, America has a clue what they are. But we love Christmas crackers. Invented by Tom Smith. There he is, in 1847. So Smith claims, because he was a manufacturer of these sugared almonds that were wrapped in paper. Now he claims one Christmas, he was sitting by the fire, unwrapping one of these, and the fire went bang, just as he was opening it. And he thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice if they always went bang every time? Now, that sounds like a lie to me, but anyway, that's what he said. And sure enough, he invented the Christmas cracker. And now, Christmas table wouldn't seem right without one. And something else that might be in your Christmas parlour by now would be the Christmas card. So here's the first officially widely distributed Christmas card. So Henry Cole worked for what would become the post office, and he got sick of writing out all these handwritten notes for people every year, so he came up with the brainwave of printing them. And of course, it set a massive trend, you know, which is still alive today. It was not without controversy, though. You might see in the middle there, the little girl is drinking wine. That really upset the moralists. Very frowned on. But all of this is kind of paraphernalia. I mean, what about the spirit of Christmas? Now, how did that come back? And it's generally recognised that the turning point for that was the publication of this book here, A Christmas Carol, by Charles Dickens, of course. The problem we've got with this story is it's been overused, and there's been too many mediocre adaptations of it. And that's a shame, because if you've never read the actual book, I would really recommend that you do. It's incredibly well written, it's beautifully written. It's moving, it's scary, it's a ghost story. But you will never feel more Christmassy. Honestly, if you've never read it, you're really missing out. Don't think because you've seen this enacted by Muppets that you know that. But that is not the same thing. Anyway, you will be aware of the basic idea of it. So Ebenezer Scrooge actually is a satire. Dickens is having a dig at real people who were now around post-industrial revolution, for whom only money and business mattered. So he's having a go at these people. So Ebenezer Scrooge once loved Christmas, but now all he cares about is money. He's not a nice person. One Christmas Eve, he's visited by the ghost of his former business partner, Jacob Marley, rather eerily. Marley shows him what's in store for him in the netherworld, which is life as a wailing phantom, chained up by all the money boxes and ledgers and all the things of business that meant so much here, but mean nothing in the next world. But you're chained by them, and they now weep and they wail because they see the good they could have done in this world and didn't, and now they've lost the chance. So of course he's going to have a happy ending. So Scrooge is shown scenes from his past. In a way, it's the first time travel story. He sees Christmas around the world. Even his poor employee, Bob Cratchit, does Christmas, and he hasn't got any money. So he's shown this is not a waste of human time and money. It's actually a necessity for the human spirit. So sure enough, Scrooge changes, and the ultimate expression of this is where he does decide at the last minute to show up for dinner at the house of his nephew, who only the day before he's sent away with a bar humbug. Hence the old cliche. So it all sounds cliche, but it's actually not. If you read it, it's really powerful. And just sit by the tree one year and read it over Christmas. It'll take you a few hours. It's not a long book. Really recommend it. If you do read it, you will find this character in it, the Ghost of Christmas Present. Big, jolly, giant, robes, beard. Nah, well, who does that remind you of? Who now, around this time, is making his true ascent? So, Father Christmas, often in green and other colours at this stage. So, Father Christmas is really a very complex character made up from all kinds of origins. The earliest one seems to be Odin. So the wild hunt through the sky, we saw that. And Odin was said to fly around the house on his eight-legged horse, which they had in those days, and basically would reward the good, punish the bad. That's the flip side of it. And this gradually evolves into a more kind of warm figure. Now you can see how it evolves. And then he's more druidic, he's got the Yule log. Even by the mid-1800s, he's still quite pagan-looking. He's riding the Yule goats. Got the wassailing bowl. And it's only near the end of the 1800s that he starts to look more like what we know. Thomas Nast's famous picture here in 1881. Now he's the gift giver. And now he's beginning to blend with the character of Santa Claus. Because by now, so we're getting mixed in with St. Nicholas, the patron saint of children, and many other things as well, by the way. And Nicholas is much bigger on the continent than he is here. But we have a lot to do, for instance, with the Dutch. So the Dutch have turned him already into Sinterklaas. And he arrives on 5th of December, actually, and with his rather controversial companion, Pete, who used to be done in blackface. They won't allow that now. So Sinterklaas is a composite character that we ourselves then took and changed. We had a lot to do with Dutch colonists in America. So we imported some of these things, but not all. But around the world, there are different variations on this. In Russia, they had Grandfather Frost, or Did Moros, often in blue. Odin is said to have worn a blue robe sometimes. But you might get your presents instead from the Christkindle or the Christ Child. So in some countries, they believe the kind of the youthful spirit of Jesus is alive and comes out on Christmas. But you better hope you get some of these and not Belsnickel. Belsnickel is a much darker version of Santa Claus. And he's a bit grumpy, and if he's in a bad mood, you might get a really rubbish present. You might, if he's in a good mood, you might get something better. But hey, hope you get Belsnickel and not his one-time companion, Krampus, the Christmas demon. He seems to hang out with St. Nicholas sometimes. And you can see here what Krampus does to kids who've not been good over Christmas. So it's all quite dark, actually. But what we did here is think, let's leave all that behind. Let's have the nice Father Christmas. So we turned him into a much jollier, sort of happy chappy, flying around the sky with the reindeer. One myth that I hear over and over, and it is a myth, provable myth, is that Coca-Cola invented the red and white rose. No, they didn't. Yes, they did popularise it, that's true. It just happened to coincide with their company colours, but there's many earlier red and white Santas. And that in itself makes some people wonder where that comes from. Because up in the Siberian wastelands, you get tribes like the Sami. Now they celebrate the fly agaric mushroom. So the fly agaric, if you imbibe it, is said to give you these incredible shamanic experiences, you see. So the only issue we've got here is you can't just pick a fly agaric and eat it because you're probably going to be pretty ill. What you have to do is let the reindeer eat it first and drink the reindeer wee-wee. And this is what they do. And they claim then you get these incredible spiritual experiences. So maybe then it wouldn't be such a stretch to imagine you fly through the sky with a reindeer, man. And it's true. And so next time you see a little Santa or a red and white mushroom, that's probably why. It's true. So there's so many different origins to all of this. All rather fascinating. Although ultimately, man in the sky, white beard, incredible powers, who does that remind us of? Because basically, Father Christmas is kind of a seasonal version of the classic God, to be frank. And why not? You can see how that might evolve. Now, we always say, don't we, that Father Christmas lives at the North Pole. We associate snow and ice with this time, even though often it isn't now. But of course, between the 1500s and the mid-1800s, we were in the Little Ice Age. And, you know, the Thames used to freeze over and all this. And so, you know, in the collective memory, Christmas often was white. So by the time Bing starts singing about all this in 1942, there is a genuine memory for some people attached to the real white Christmas. This song is said to be the most successful song of all time in terms of sales. And I think there's good reason for that, because of course we were at war when this song was released. And people stationed around the world in places they'd rather not be, hearing this song, it pulled them back into nostalgia and, you know, a memory of how Christmas once was, and of course how they hoped it would be again. So although it sounds a bit schmaltzy to us today, in its time, it was very moving for many people. Anyway, just because it's wartime doesn't mean you get rid of all the old traditions, does it? One thing you read over and over is that kissing under the mistletoe is a Norse practice. Well, maybe. Certainly mistletoe was given as a sign of love and friendship, and the Druids use it. There's actually no record of anybody kissing under it until at least the 1700s, so it might be that's a little bit more modern. It's a brief mention of another war, because of course in World War I you get the Christmas truces. And it's been hugely exaggerated, this story. It did not happen right across the trenches, but it did happen in a few places, like here, where our troops stop killing the enemy, they stop killing us, and they climb out and sing carols and have cigarettes and play football. Is this picture a test? And then, after Christmas, they get back in their trenches and start killing each other again, because that's the human race for you. But it's a rather nice moment. Rather sadly, though, this was widely seen as fraternisation. Didn't go down well with the public at all. And in later years, in the First World War, it all got stopped, which is perhaps a bit sad. Now, after World War II, suddenly things changed. Germany, of course, has got issues. It's got to rebuild itself. And the German Christmas is now not so popular. So America starts to set the trend for Christmas. And America's doing very nicely, thank you. I mean, we're probably pasting together newspaper paper chains, and money was not so rife here. But in America, no, they're doing well. So children are encouraged to ask for bigger presents, better bikes, nicer dolls. Now, of course, they want a 150-quid computer game, and that's another story. But the arms race really begins here. And it's around this time that you start for the first time to see the pressures of Christmas being depicted. And this is really where that slight cynicism about Christmas starts to creep in, especially in this country, because we're very prone to Christmas grumbling over here. But I think this is to mistake commercial Christmas with actual Christmas. It's not the same thing at all. And I mean, to be fair, you cannot help but feel resentful when Santa's trying to sell you cigarettes, you know. Merry Christmas for every smoker, and stop the rest of you. So this is now being used, Christmas is being used to sell dreams. And ladies, what would you like for Christmas the most? Could it be? Well, Christmas morning, you'll be happier with a hoover. So, you know, you can see kind of what's going on. Maybe you would be, I don't know, but you can see what's going on here. Now, I mean, other things come out of this that are good. Christmas lighting gets cheaper. Might still burn your house down, but it's getting there. Although, of course, that also begins another arms race that might have got slightly out of hand by now. But think about it, though. Christmas lights. I mean, that is the essence of Christmas. Because whichever way you look at it, it's always been about light in the darkness, celebrating the return of the light. So to stick a little light on, you are very much in the spirit of it. But shops, of course, also realise this. So they become grottos, They use it, they draw people in, and of course this is where some people get a little bit annoyed. Christmas shopping, I mean, no matter how much you do online now, you'll still probably wind up on the streets doing it somewhere. I personally don't mind it. If you get to the spirit of it, you just say, hey, I'm going to sing along with the rubbish songs and enjoy it. It's rather nice. It's when you don't know what to buy people. That's when you get completely worn out at the end of the day, isn't it? But I do think buying presents for people is a good thing to do at Christmas. Because again, it is in the spirit of it. It's long been a time where you have a lovely time, but you also think of others. And when you're having to buy a gift for others, and we tend to do this more at Christmas than any other time, you're having to think outside of your own selfish needs. And you're thinking, what would make this other person happy? What would be nice for them? And that's, I think, a useful thing to do. And I mean, similarly, if you write Christmas cards still, I know that's something I personally get my dog to write. Now, I mean, what's interesting, a lot of people predicted the death of the card and it hasn't happened. Yes, there's slowly sales are going down because of social media, but actually nowhere near as fast as people thought, because some people still like sticking a bit of card in an envelope. And it might be, especially if you're not on the internet, the one time you think of that one person you've not had any contact with all year, but just give them that 5 minutes is a nice thing to do. So this is all the plus side of commercial Christmas. The downside of it is this kind of poster here. This is American, I know, but Christmas shopping madness. Right, look at the eyes. You'd think it was a war, wouldn't you, on Christmas? And then, of course, we've got all this Black Friday insanity that's been imported in, which is just basically a materialistic con to get you all to part with your money very quickly and make them nice and rich. When you look around, you can often get better bargains elsewhere, so if you want to scrabble and fight people to buy a telly, well, fine, get on with it, but don't believe that it's part of Christmas. That's what it's been sold to us now. It's part of your Christmas experience. No, it's not. It's got absolutely nothing to do with it. Now, one good commercial thing, and I think we need to get back now to the real meaning of Christmas, was this record here. Do They Know It's Christmas? Right, you can be as cynical as you want about charity records, but to be fair, the song itself is good. It says, have a lovely time. That's great, but also you might want to think about people who are not having such a lovely time. Well, that's good. That's very much in the spirit of it. And it's raised lots of money over the years and various versions since the original. Some other great Christmas records. Here it is, Merry Christmas. It might shock you to know this is not a hit anywhere else but Britain. Right? It flopped everywhere else. But if you actually listen to it, it's obvious why. It's such a British song. It's about the British Christmas. But one song that has more international appeal is John Lennon, of course. So this is Christmas, and what have you done? And that second line is a killer, really, isn't it? Because it makes people think, oh yeah, my God, what have I done? Another year's over. But that's quite nice. It makes you think, takes you a little bit more deeply. So anyway, in all the polls taken in the last 2 or 3 years, what's, according to all the polls, the most loved Christmas record in Britain today? Yes, it is? Anyone? Yeah, well done. The Pogues. No, White Christmas doesn't feature. So, A Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues is now the nation's favourite Christmas song. Now, when you say that, you always get people go, oh, I've never heard it. Yes, you have. If you've ever stood in a shop or had to tell your neighbour Christmas, you've heard this song. And it's the one that goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And actually, when you listen to it, of course, it's about a couple breaking up over Christmas and have a great big row in New York and slack each other off. But you see, people like it because, hey, it is a great tune and it's very Christmassy. But it also reminds you that it doesn't always go straightforwardly at Christmas. There are people that get naff Christmases. There's a lot of loneliness at Christmas. And people appreciate the song because it kind of acknowledges that. And if we do know anybody that's going to be lonely, well, a simple phone call or a knock at the door can make all the difference, can't it? So we always need to remember that. Yeah, have a great time, but do think of others too. Better to do that than go the other way. Christmas by off. Christmas grumbling is a real disease now in our nation. And I say it ought to now stop. And when you see these anti-Christmas stickers, especially when they can't even spell, you do have to get annoyed, really. Because I think they're fundamentally misunderstanding. They're seeing commercial Christmas as everything. It's not, is it? Okay, you can't stop that. That's always going to be there. You've got to separate it out. I mean, what if we did cancel Christmas anyway? Well, that worked well last time, didn't it, when the Puritans did it? People rioted to get Christmas back. And if you think about it, I mean, if you didn't have Christmas, how long and dismal would the winter seem? Oh, God, it would go on forever, wouldn't it? And look, even the ancients knew you needed that festival of light in the middle of the dark time. You get it over the bump. They recognised that, and if you took it away, we'd only reinvent it again, just like the Scots did. So maybe we ought to cherish Christmas a little bit more. And anyway, whatever you think about it, the following will all be going on in the next few weeks. If you're a kid, marvellous time. Do you remember how you felt as a kid? I do. Magic. Eat, drink and be merry. Nothing wrong with a bit of that here and there, eh? What's ail? Drink your glasses. Be in good health. You can always improvise if you aren't by yourself. There are just certain tropes of Christmas, love them or hate them, they're going to be there. And I sort of think, hey, why don't you just give into it? Put a silly jumper on. Just have a bit of a laugh and go for it. I mean, look at this bloke. He's got it right in my school. Are you on a little bit of misrule? I've no idea what's going on there, but that's great. But if you do want a slightly more solemn side to it, I always think there's a moment that you get over Christmas. Now, you can choose it to some degree, but I think the best time is the early hours of Christmas morning. About 1 in the morning, you might be, if you're religious, coming back from midnight mass, or you might be coming out of the pub, but finally people are drifting home, and the children across the nation hopefully are finally asleep, and it really is stilling. It's like, now at the time of the year, there's the silent night, you know, silent night. It stills. And personally, I always like to just have a little time, and just sit quietly, because by the next day, right, the madness starts, and you're not going to get a chance again. And I just like to just, you can call it what you want, meditate or pray or whatever, just to centre in. And I like to just think about where this has come from. Because it's meant different things over the years. And yet, as I said at the beginning, it's also always been the same. It celebrates light in the darkness. And the world can be dark sometimes, as we all know. So why not celebrate light? Every now and then, doesn't do any harm. And whether you see that light as the Messiah, the light of the world returning, or literally the sun returning, does it matter? Does it matter? And I don't think it does. One last Christmas song. One of the great Christmas songs is Greg Lane, who sadly died at Christmas again. There we go. And the song, I Believe in Father Christmas, is the one that goes, they said there'll be snow at Christmas. You know that one? Have you ever heard the words? Right, next time you hear it, stop and listen to the words, because it's not what you always think. It's actually a song of disillusionment to begin with. So they said there'll be snow at Christmas, and he looks out the window, oh, and it's raining. And he comes down to see Santa in the middle of the night and sees through his disguise, and you think, oh no, that's a bit miserable. The reason this song is so loved, though, is if you then listen to the last verse, it kind of pulls it all together and says, yeah, but none of that matters. Because Christmas is ultimately what you make it. And I really like the last verse. I'll just quote you the last verse here, because it's apt. And forgive me singing. But he goes, I wish you a hopeful Christmas. I wish you a brave new year. All anguish, pain and sadness, leave your heart and let your road be clear. They say there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Hallelujah. Noel, be it heaven or hell, Christmas you get, you deserve. Oh, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? There's kind of a truth to it. Now, look, I recognise in quoting that you don't always get to be where you want to be at Christmas. Sometimes you're with people you don't necessarily want to be, or with people to look after. It can be difficult, but you can get the Christmas you want in here. Because ultimately, this is where it resides. It's what you choose it to be. I mean, all this is lovely. I mean, I love Christmas lights and all that. Marvellous. It's not Christmas. It's only what we attach to it. Christmas is in here. And therefore, you can have whatever kind of Christmas you want, or if you prefer, don't have it at all. So, I hope I've drawn a few threads together for you here. If after all of this, you're still bar humbug, right? There's nothing more I can do for you. For everyone else, well, have a happy Christmas. Thanks very much.
the information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.